Welcome to Network Capital, Mr. Selvam. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well.
Thank you so much for accepting our invitation to be a part of Network Capital. Could you tell us a bit about yourself and what do you do?
I did my initial training in science, but in 1984, when the Bhopal gas tragedy happened, quite a lot of people who were trained in science and technology made a lateral induction into policies and journalism. And I was one of them. I left science to become a journalist. Therefore, in 1984, following the Bhopal gas tragedy, I moved to journalism. And since then, I have been a journalist.
Yeah.
And my last 10 years, I was the reader's editor for the Hindu newspaper.
And you've written extensively about policy and politics in India. Can you tell us about your latest work and how did you come to find a book within it?
I've been working on a key aspect of the two trajectories of India. One is coming together, another one is holding together. And for this, I felt that politics of Kashmir, politics of Tamil Nadu, politics of Punjab, politics of Bihar, all of them give an idea of and coming together idea as opposed to holding together. Holding together empowers the capital and coming together empowers people. Therefore, I wanted to understand this coming together politics much more closely. And that's how I started looking at the Dravidian movement and its impact on Indian polity. And DMK is one of the oldest regional parties in the country. It was established in 1949. Therefore, initially, I wanted to understand how a political party which was established immediately in the aftermath of post-colonial struggle as a regional party trying to negotiate space for state rights. See, what we have to keep in mind is after the 1947 partition, there was an attempt for a centralization. And that attempt towards centralization was justified because partition was used as an excuse. Since partition was used as an excuse, you have a political party here which says that you can't use partition as an excuse for hyper-centralization. Partition is a completely different issue, but the way we govern should be different. The way we govern should retain its idea of decentralized federal balance. This idea was a very, very interesting and nuanced one. And this idea was not actually backed by many because the impact of the partition was so profound that this viewpoint took some time to gain traction. In fact, if you look at even the state's political trajectory, till 1967, national parties were winning. Only by 1967, people realized the need for decentralized polity. Only after 1967 in Tamil Nadu, national parties have lost out. Therefore, that entire trajectory was so interesting for me. I wanted to look at how this party adjusts itself for a post-liberalized India. Therefore, the post-1991, I wanted to know how this party is going to adjust itself. I could really understand party's moorings with reference to a pre-liberalized India. But in a post-liberalized India, how are you going to adjust your decentralized federal ambitions? That was my interest. And that's how I got into this idea of doing a work on the DMK. But when I started working on this book on DMK, I realized that Karunanidhi happens to be the central of this DMK imagination because he was party president from 69 and he has been the fulcrum of the party from the day party was established in 49. So I thought that if I can understand the trajectory of the party to the personal life of Karunanidhi, then it might be helpful to even look at the challenges they faced and how they negotiated those challenges. And that's how the book, which started as a history of DMK, becomes a biography of Karunanidhi. And it was by Penguin 2 years ago. And it's called Karunanidhi Alive.
So thank you very much for sharing. A large chunk of our readers actually come from India, but an equally large part come from people living outside India. So you'll have to explain who Karunanidhi is and why DMK matters to an international audience, if you don't mind.
See, DMK is an offshoot of something called self-respect movement. Self-respect movement is more than 100 years old. It's a political imagination from South. Here the idea is to look at caste as a marker, and you can't use caste to discriminate against anybody. Therefore, the entire idea is to imagine an egalitarian society where caste will not be used to humiliate anybody and to respect people's dignity. That's the reason this movement is called the self-respect movement. And the self-respect movement had initially a political trajectory called Justice Party. Then it had a social mobilization alone in the form of Dravida Kazhagam under Periyar. But later in 1949, when Annadurai is split away from DK, that is led by Periyar, to form DMK or the Dravida Munnetra Kazhagam, it becomes a political party because it says that it's important to negotiate the political space to retain our rights. And it is not really easy to be a regional party in the wake of partition. Because in the wake of partition, any regional aspiration was seen with suspicion. Therefore, at that point, the larger onus of explaining the idea of decentralized governance was with the DMK. And that's the reason DMK did not contest the very first general election in 1952, because it wanted to train people to understand the aspects of political aspirations. In fact, it enters electoral arena only in 1957 in the second general election. Therefore, it actually prepares people for political aspirations, which has a decentralized political imagination. And to explain this decentralized political imagination, they use theater and they use cinema. For all forms of articulation was used by this political mobilization. The key aspect of this political mobilization is it is a political mobilization of people from less privileged background. Therefore, these people from less privileged background came together to come up with an alternative political narrative to the dominant national political narrative at that point of time. And by 1967, this imagination comes to power. And this imagination coming to power, in a sense, redefined Indian body polity in more than one way.
And Mr. Karunanidhi had a role to play. Could you explain why that was the case?
Karunanidhi is a founder member of the DMK. And he was one of the young but very articulate member of the party. He was a writer. He was a scriptwriter, and he was also a playwright. Therefore, he used all forms of articulation to propagate the movement. In fact, the movement did not have the resources of, say, Indian National Congress. Indian National Congress had resources as well as mainstream media's backing. But DMK had to build on two of its core strengths, which is speech and writing. Therefore, in fact, the DMK leaders used to say that we had only two assets, our tongue and our pen. Using their tongue and their pen, they actually built up this entire movement. And Mr. Karunanidhi was central in using pen and tongue to build this entire organization. And he created two major cinematic icons, M.G. Ramachandran and Sivaji Ganesan, through which he was able to reach out to a larger population to explain what the movement is all about. By creating M.G. Ramachandran in 49 and Sivaji Ganesan in 1952, Mr. Karunanidhi emerges not only as a powerful film writer, but also a person who can generate icons who can be used to propagate your viewpoint. That's the reason Mr. Karunanidhi becomes so central in this political imagination.
So writing about somebody as complex and multi-layered as Karunanidhi would have needed you to structure the book in a very difficult way, I would imagine. How did you go about doing that?
See, the problem is he had to confront a fundamental difference of him being from less privileged background. At every place, he had to interact with people who were more privileged than him. When he joined the DMK, almost all the DMK leaders had post-graduation. Anna was an MA, Mr. Niranjan was an MA, Mr. Anbaragan was an MA. All of them had a post-graduation. And here you had Karunanidhi, who had only school final. But that gap did not make him feel inferior to them. He dealt with them as equal. Then when he entered film world, he had to work with two major iconic film personalities, T.R. Sundaram, who established the modern theaters in Salem, and Mr. Ellis Duncan, who was a legendary filmmaker. Ellis Duncan, by that time, had already created two big names, M.S. Subbulakshmi and G.N. Balasubramaniam. Therefore, you have somebody like Ellis Duncan on one side, and you have T.R. Sundaram on the other side, who have traveled all over the world to establish a studio in Salem. And you have Mr. Karunanidhi, whose entire travel till then was from his hometown in Tanjore district to Salem. But that did not make him second to anyone. Therefore, that is the key one. Therefore, he becomes a symbol of hope, where your lack of privilege doesn't make you second to anyone, and you can negotiate with the best in the field. Therefore, he, in that sense, Karunanidhi becomes a symbol of hope.
And that would have been something that gave you the impetus to write. But the book sort of captures different phases of the evolution of Karunanidhi as a person, as a politician, and how he navigated power. So could you give us a glimpse of that structuring? How have you divided the book into various parts?
See, book is very, very clearly divided as the one before 1967, that is the year DMK comes to power, and post-1991, that is the post-liberalized India. There are three clear components. One is from Karunanidhi's birth in 1924 till 1967, because that is one continuous path, though it might be seen as pre-colonial era moving into an independent era. It has one continuous trajectory of centralizing forces versus decentralizing forces. If you broadly look at it, that is the difference. And that one, the key aspect was the linguistic freedom. The struggle for the rights for Tamil is the most important political struggle for linguistic freedom. And this linguistic plurality is the one which DMK stood for in a much bigger way, and it articulated it in a most unambiguous manner. In fact, today, if India is remaining plural, primarily because of the hard work put by this party, it tried to explain the difference between homogenizing tendencies and the heterogenizing plurality. Mm-hmm. And to understand heterogeneizing plurality, one of the easiest tests we can use is the linguistic plurality. Therefore, what you have to realize is Tamil Nadu's struggle for linguistic rights predates Government of India's move to linguistically reorganize the states. Our linguistic reorganization of the states happened in mid-50s. But Tamil Nadu's right for language struggle goes back to 1938. Therefore, from 1938, it's been talking about plurality of India. And for plurality of India, it realized that language is a key one. And this has actually paid a good dividend for South India. See, if you look at South India, it has a thriving film industry. In Tamil, in Malayalam, in Kannada, in Telugu. This thriving film industry would not have happened if it had surrendered its rights to an homogenizing single language imagination. Probably it would have met the same fate as, say, Gujarati cinema, which has been subsumed under the power of Hindi cinema. The key question is, what happened in Tamil Nadu was not only about Tamil Nadu, but about the Dravida area, which means it's below Vindhyas, which means it has a profound impact on all the five states of South India. And that we can now prove with empirical evidence, the thriving publishing industry, the thriving literary tradition, the thriving cinema, the thriving theater, all those things stand testimony for the plurality of the region. And that was essentially a political struggle, which happened despite all the fears which happened post-partition.
I really found this explanation of plurality fascinating in the context that we are today, not just as a country, but the world. These forces are sort of making their presence felt today in unexpected ways, but a lot can be learned by studying history. And I think your book does a really good job of explaining the various forces, linguistic, historical, philosophical, you know, issues of identity quite powerfully. But when you sort of put them all together, I have to ask, how did Mr. Karunanidhi manage to get to power? Was there a Machiavellian streak? Would you say the quest of the mission that he put forward particularly strong? Was he great at forming alliances? All of the above, none of the above. What's your perspective?
It's a combination. He drew from various streams of ideas to negotiate. In fact, one of the famous utterances of Mr. Karunanidhi is that DMK is one force which uses both sword and the shield. Therefore, sometimes it is quite aggressive, sometimes it's defensive. Therefore, this entire balancing between sword and shield, I think, captures the way DMK managed to negotiate these difficulties. That's the reason it waited for 10 years from independence to enter electoral arena. India gained independence in 47 and DMK enters electoral battle only in 57. It used these 10 years to understand where the problems will be. And one of the areas where it felt the problems might be are entrenched interests, like say courts. It says, therefore, I can come up with a very progressive legislation, but that progressive legislation might be stalled by the court. And DMK's imagination of the role of higher courts being the center for status quo was well justified when the very first affirmative action, which came from the self-respect movement, it's called the communal GO or the preferential reservation, and that reservation was struck down by the courts. Therefore, the government of India had to bring in an amendment to our constitution. In fact, our first amendment as opposed to the US First Amendment. Our First Amendment is to safeguard the government's space to implement affirmative actions. And that happened because of the Tamil Nadu's political trajectory. And Karunanidhi was central to this entire struggle. Therefore, he has seen the bottlenecks in making changes. And the way he knew where will be the bureaucratic bottleneck, where will be the judicial bottleneck, and where will be the financial bottleneck. Since he understood this interlocking bottlenecks, he was able to negotiate it, and he had been in the public life for such a long time. He enters Legislative Assembly in 1957, and he was a member till his last day in 2017, which means for nearly 70 years he was there, which means he has also seen the entire trajectory of negotiation. And through these negotiations, he was able to look at how to negotiate a complex interlocking public in an effective manner. And that is the one which gave stability not only to Tamil Nadu, but to India on three occasions. First was in 1969, when the Congress Party went through a major split. When that Congress Party split happened, it was Karunanidhi's DMK, which provided the stability for Mrs. Gandhi to survive. But for Karunanidhi's support, I don't think Mr. V.V. Giri would have become the president. But for Karunanidhi's support, I don't think bank nationalization would have happened. I don't think Mrs. Gandhi's stability, which actually led to her getting a one more term in 1971, would have happened, but for the DMK's steadfast support, which means DMK has provided national level stability. Next aspect is DMK's role in creating the Janata Party in 77. And then the DMK's role with the UPA, DMK's role with the NDA 2, all those things are well documented. Those are recent developments. People know that, but a lot of people don't remember the role played by DMK in providing stability between 69 and 71 and in creation of the Janata Party in 77, which means your regional imagination also provides a very solid base for a national stability.
That is so true. Could you walk us through some of the most challenging moments in Mr. Karunanidhi's life and the evolution of DMK while going through all of these tectonic changes?
I think the first challenge for Mr. Karunanidhi will be the 1962 Government of India's decision to ban a political party which was asking for more independent trajectory. This is after the Chinese War. At that point of time, party makes a major decision of moving away from the demand for a separate country towards a far more inclusive federal demands. Therefore, the 1962 moment is the most crucial moment of wielding the shield rather than the sword. Then comes the position of the party in 1971. In 1971, after the DMK getting the absolute majority in the State Assembly, it gets about 184 seats out of 234. It has to face the insecurity of Delhi. Delhi was completely insecure of a state which had so much of popular support. Today, we talk about central agencies being deployed to weaken the regional political parties. We know what happened with Shiv Sena. We know what happened with Trinamool Congress. We know what happened with National Conference. We know what happened with PDP. But all those things happened for the DMK in 71. The party was split. M.G. Ramachandran was asked to lead a rebellion. And this M.G. Ramachandran's rebellion was actually aided by the center. There was center deploying its forces to weaken a regional force is not new. what we are seeing today, some of the ills we are facing today, for that, the earlier template is there in the experience of the DMK. And also DMK's experience tells us that these excesses can be resisted. It does not mean that you have to meekly surrender. Yes, there are excesses, but you can resist it. That's what that his life exemplifies. And the key question is, this is followed by 1976 dismissal of the state government itself. Had the state government endorsed the emergency, it would have survived. We have to understand what happened around 76. In 76, during the height of emergency, a regional political party called ADMK, led by Mr. M.G. Ramachandran, re-Christians itself as All India Anna Dravida Munnetra Kazhagam, because it does not want to have a regional character to it. It was so scared of its regional character. Whereas DMK stood by its regional character, opposed emergency, lost the government, but losing the government helped to gain the strength for the movement, helped to gain for the idea of India. Mm-hmm. That's the reason. Therefore, I think that the two dismissals of the DMK government, the 1976 dismissal and the 1991 dismissal, 1976 dismissal happened because DMK defended rights for democracy and it opposed emergency. 1991, it played a big role in the implementation of the huge social justice project called Mandal Commission.
Yeah.
And it opposed the Kar Seva of the BJP. Opposing Kar Seva of the BJP and implementing of Mandal led to its dismissal in 1991. I think in both the cases, it might have lost the government, but it gained immensely as a political force. Therefore, losing the government did not weaken it. On the other hand, it strengthened the party. It not only strengthened the party, it also gave courage to people that you can stand up and fight for your rights. You might have a temporary setback, but eventually it will lead to transformative polity.
And the role of caste in DMK's outlook, has that been changing over the coming years? And where does it stand today?
DMK understood that we can't use class alone as a marker to understand our society, because class is interchangeable. Today I can be a middle class person, and tomorrow through my hard work I can become a upper class person. Due to my ill luck, my middle class status might fall down and I can become a lower income person. Therefore, the class is a category which is very, very fluid. And class as a category has very little to do with the most deplorable human experience called humiliation. To understand the idea of humiliation and fight for dignity, we have to use a category through which people encounter humiliation. It's only with the caste people encounter humiliation. Hence, caste has to be a category through which we understand our vertical hierarchy of our society. And if you want to transform this society, you have to understand caste is a reality. And caste is not only a deplorable reality, caste as a reality brings in a vertical hierarchy which divides people. Hence, there's a need to bring in affirmative actions so that people feel that they can fight this battle on a more fair manner. Therefore, DMK has a very, very clear idea. It says that we make a distinction between equality and uniformity. Equality does not mean that a person who belongs to a privileged background and who is a fourth generation graduate and somebody from a rural background who's a first generation graduate are same.
Mm-hmm.
They are unequal. Hence, there is a need for recognizing the layered reality of India. Hence, the need for our affirmative actions. And these affirmative actions has to take into account the layered reality of India. And that within that layer of, see, DMK understood what Dr. B.R. Ambedkar rightly pointed out as graded inequality. Therefore, DMK, whenever it comes to the caste question, it doesn't take an easy bipolar question of upper caste versus untouchability. It also takes into account of the whole range of intermediate section of people. Therefore, the moment you understand it as a graded inequality, you come up with an interlocking policy which covers various people. That's the reason in Tamil Nadu, you have quite a lot of internal reservations. There's a reservation for backward classes. Within backward classes, there is a reservation for the most backward classes. There is a reservation for scheduled caste. Within scheduled caste, there's an internal reservation for Arundhatiyar, who are most backward among the Dalits in Tamil Nadu. This idea of internal reservation is an attempt to understand that this inequality is graded. And since the inequality is graded, you have to keep addressing it on a constant basis. Therefore, we can't assume that one size fits all and to think that one-time action will do. It's a process, and the process itself is a journey. A process is a journey, and it's not the destination. Reservation is not a destination, but reservation is a process and a journey.
It seems like now most political parties are going down that path of giving adequate emphasis on affirmative action. So in that changing landscape, how has DMK evolved its value proposition to its core voter base?
The key question is how it built on from one level to another level. It did not stop with an idea of just reservation. It blended its idea of reservation with economic transformation and social transformation. Therefore, what we have to look at in Tamil Nadu is, for instance, in 1991, when liberalization happened, Tamil Nadu emerged as one of the biggest investment destinations. And how did this human resources emerge in this state? This human resources emerged in the state because state was known for its social investment. It had invested in people. Therefore, they were educated workforce, which was ready. Sorry. This educated workforce did not come from a vacuum. It was a political project and political. See, in 1967, when DMK came to power, PDS in Tamil Nadu was restricted to two cities, Chennai and Coimbatore. Tamil Nadu has one of the best PDS system in the world. And that expansion happened within 5 years. And today, Tamil Nadu has the best GER, the gross enrollment ratio. This highest gross enrollment ratio or the best numbers and the number of people who register for PhD, the highest is in Tamil Nadu, which means you are not looking at these affirmative actions at a narrow sense. We look at these affirmative actions as a social transformative investment. That's the reason Tamil Nadu politicians, none of them, look at social expenditure as expenditure. They see it as an investment for future. Whether it's our noon meal scheme, whether it's our free school education, whether it is a free graduation till Tamil medium till BA, all those things are never seen as freebies. They were seen as investment for future. And this investment for the future is the one which transformed our social indicators. You can't look at Tamil Nadu's social indicators without realizing how much social investment has gone into it. The social investment is the one which resulted in this fine social indicators. These indicators did not come from on its own. People worked to get that here, those numbers.
And when you're embarking upon such a challenge, I'm sure controversy is a friend or something that keeps happening. So what do you think have been some of the major lessons that DNK and its supporters have learned through the controversy it has seen over the past 50 years?
One thing what they have learned is not to respond to a controversy without addressing the core issue. The core issues are fight for dignity and the role of the state. And even in a liberalized environment, it realizes the limits of the state. If you realize the limits of the state, then what should be the role of the state? It is one state where liberalization worked very well. It is a huge investment destination. It is a manufacturing state. It is also a state where you have a big service industry. Therefore, you have a manufacturing industry, you have a service sector, and yet it also is a state where there's a well-connected social investment. Therefore, this marrying market and welfare is the best lesson what now DMK is offering. Therefore, now DMK says that we need not have to learn, others have to learn. You are going to look at the Gujarat model or your Dravidian model. People have to now decide what is the role of the Gujarat model. Gujarat model gets a higher gross numbers, but what is the individual numbers? Tamil Nadu is one. The inequality is the lowest, and Gujarat the inequality is the maximum. Therefore, the key question is, now their position is that we need not have to learn. Others have to learn from our 60 years of experience because we have empirical evidence to say that we have delivered. Our gender ratio is far better. Our urban-rural gap is the lowest in the country. Our gross enrollment ratio is comparable to the Scandinavian countries. We have enough professionals across the board. Therefore, people have to look at what we have to offer rather than what we have to learn. Others have to now learn, and now others have to adjust themselves to understand how this transformation happened.
That's an important point worth paying attention to. How do you think the future of DMK looks like? What are your thoughts on the subject?
See, the two major political parties of Tamil Nadu, DMK and ADMK, have a huge cadre-based support. And that cadre-based support gives a particular type of vibrancy to these parties. These two parties are going to survive. And they are not going to fade away. Therefore, I don't see issue on that. And DMK, even the next generation is now ready. But certain initiatives like what they are doing with their social media handles or with their new platform, which means the party is next generation ready.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time, for your insights, and for your writing this thought-provoking book. Is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't, or any parting words for our listeners from India and around the world?
Sorry. We spoke about a book which I wrote 2 years ago. I thought that we are going to talk about the book which Penguin published just now. That is out of
transition to that. On like we're closing this topic and moving on to the current book.
Oh, thanks. Then, as I said, DMK offers an of coming together as opposed to holding together.
Well, thank you very much for your time and insights. And now, shall we segue to part two, where we discuss your current book? So, tell us what made that happen. What was the thought process behind writing the second book?
A second book, I did not write. I did the translation.
Yeah.
This terminology, Mr. M.K. Stalin's autobiography. It covers the first 2 years from 1953 to 1976 when he was arrested during emergency. The book ends with him getting arrested. Therefore, for me, the key question is to also understand the political trajectory of the current leadership of the DMK.
Mm-hmm.
All the things he witnessed. Therefore, there were two elements in that autobiography. One was bearing witness, another one is making sense. Therefore, he was witness to quite a lot of defining political happenings. At the same time, he was also witness to how people made sense of those developments.
Yeah.
Therefore, in 1992, when the party decided to give up Dravidanadu demand, or in 1967, when Annadurai formed a broader coalition which Congress, and after that, national parties are yet to gain any foothold in the state. Therefore, that 1967, how did that broader coalition was built? And how did the people get this stronger regional center was always suspicious of regional. The key question is all every regional party has a split, and none of these split happened on its own. With Shiv Sena now, I think the generation understands the role of union government in effecting split with regional centers. But when the DMK split happened in 71 and 72, I don't think nationally people really understand the role of union in getting suspicious of powerful state entities. These factors have been documented in a fragmented manner. We know about what happened with National Conference War, a period of Sheikh Abdullah's arrest. We know about what happened with Shiromani Akali Dal. We know about some of the other regional parties which are forced to merge with Congress. All those things we know as a fragmented idea. But we never know about somebody who had the courage to stand up and say that, okay, you can commit, but you cannot destroy. And this act of resistance is so central in that book. And that's the reason I thought I should do the translation. And he has done it in such an effortless, easy way of conveying what was happening.
And what were the important takeaways for you from the book? You've been studying this state, studying this party for a long time. We've discussed some of that in the previous segment of our chat. But for you, what mattered?
For me, this organic relationship between personal and political becomes so important. Therefore, your political is going to be informed by your personal, and your personal is getting defined by the political reality in which you live. Therefore, that symbiotic relationship between the external and the internal. In Tamil, we have this category called Agam and Puram. Therefore, Agam deals purely with your external, and Puram deals with external. What is autobiography did is to bring that interlocking aspect of external and internal, agam and puram, personal and political. The other is how personal influences your political choices, how your political reality shapes your personal choices. That comes out so well in that through its lived experience. And the key aspect is Stalin was born in 1950. By that time, Mr. Karunanidhi was a big star. He had already created M.G. Ramachandran. He had already created Swaraj Ganesan. He was the most sought-after film writer of that period. Therefore, when Stalin was born as a son of a leader, which means when you are born as a son of a leader of a movement, trying to generate space for itself, which was highly contested at that point of time. At that point of time, Tamil Nadu politics was dominated by Congress, followed by the left.
Yeah.
He negotiated the space which was dominated by two sets of veterans, veterans of Congress and veterans of the left. It means you need interesting interventions. Those interesting interventions shape Stalin's understanding. And that's the reason today Stalin has emerged as a fulcrum for this opposition unity also. Because he brings in those experiences of watching how party brought others together in 1967, how party played a big role in providing stability for Mrs. Gandhi when the party suffered a split in 69, helped to bring other parties together to form the UPO1 and UPO2. These are all valid experiences, and those experiences are now paying to bring the opposition together. And for me, to understand how India is working, India as a political alliance is working, his earlier experience seems to provide some sort of insight.
I understand. How do you explain Mr. Stalin's relationship with the ruling party, the opposition party, the people in the state, and how does he think about navigating this complex web of relationships?
Mr. Stalin has a very good working relationship with the Union government, but with the BJP as a political party, there is a huge ideological divide. Therefore, he makes that distinction very clearly between having a warm relationship with the Union government, but being critical of centralizing BJP is his imagination. At the same time, he is also worried about the centralization tendencies which are happening over the last 5-6 years. Now there's an attempt to even take away corporations and the corporates and the cooperatives to the concurrent list. DMK has been trying to get education into the state list. When it is trying to get education back into the state, looking at the amount of centralization, it is trying to negotiate with other political parties to understand and to bring in certain amount of pressure. Not all the efforts have paid dividend. For instance, it wanted a solution of national education policy, NEP. It felt that NEP should not have been a national policy. It should have been clearly a state subject. And it says that given our experience with the indicators about our educational achievements, why should we take something from center? What is that your special expertise that makes you to dictate these policies for us? Same thing with the Viswakarma scheme of the Prime Minister. Tamil Nadu thinks that DMK thinks very clearly that this Viswakarma scheme is reinforcing caste differences. Why should somebody have to practice what their family practiced illegally? Don't you think people would like to move away from those type of inheritance? Is it an inheritance of pride, or it's also inheritance of certain amount of humiliation? So these are all the undercurrent, and because this state opposed such a much earlier during Rajaji's time. Rajaji tried to bring in a similar scheme, and that scheme was called Kulakalitam by DMK, and opposed it. It says that this, you are trapping people in their caste. You are not permitting people to move away from the caste. This is not empowering artisans, but this is trapping the people within their caste confines. Therefore, given the fact that DMK was to NEP, DMK to Vishwakarma scheme, DMK is now taking the task of forming a larger political alliance to retain these rights at the state level.
Do you feel that DMK will be happy with a state role? Do you see DMK trying to forge a more national rule for itself? And what do you think would be Mr. Stalin's approach towards this question?
See, I think DMK's focus will be Tamil Nadu, but it will try to share its Tamil Nadu experience nationally. That's what it did always. And whenever DMK is part of the national arrangements, it joined the Union Cabinet first in 1989. And during that 1989-90, it played a big role in getting Mandal Commission implemented. And in 1996 to 1998, when it was part of the UF, it played a big role in stabilizing our economy after the initial ups and downs of liberalization. Over the first 5 years of Narasimha Rao, showed both ups and downs. It was 2 years of the UF, P. Chidambaram as a finance minister and Muruswari Maran as the industries minister, stabilized our economy. Therefore, whenever they are part of the national arrangement, they aid in stabilizing. And then in 2001, DMK member Muruswari Maran led the government of India's commerce delegation to the Doha round of talks of WTO, the rights of third world countries itself. Therefore, whenever it plays a larger role, it empowers all the states as well as it also is India state to respect that the states can deliver far better for the states. Let's not forget that it was India's arrangement with Bangladesh on Faraka deal happened during the UF government, because DMK said better for Mr. Jyoti Basu as the Chief Minister of West Bengal to negotiate with West Bengal or with Bangladesh rather than having a joint secretary from Delhi negotiating it. Therefore, Faraka happened primarily because of the DMK's idea of the political leadership to do the negotiation, rather than having a diplomatic or a bureaucratic negotiation, which might have been prolonged. So whenever DMK moves to the national level, it helps national position to negotiate these issues in a far more creative manner. Therefore, for me, bank nationalization of 69 or implementation of Mandal Commission or Doha round of negotiation, these are all key points where and what DMK can bring to the table.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you make the reader experience throughout the book. A lot of people might agree with you, there'll be a lot of people who disagree with you, but it's a point worth discussing for sure. Throughout throughout this journey of translating this book and leading such a long career that comes from sciences, then looking at causes, transitioning, and seeing India transition to several phases. What is something that you believe to be eternally true about India and Indian politics?
See, this battle is going to be constant. That is, holding together and coming together is going to be an eternal battle. Indians as citizens share this idea of coming together. Nation state, in its wisdom, prefers holding together. Therefore, that holding together, which empowers state more than people, versus this idea of empowered people coming together, it's going to be the eternal struggle. And I don't think that struggle is going to end quickly. But within that struggle lies the strength of Indian democracy. Because Indian democracy oscillates between people's aspiration and the way of the nation states trying to hold together. The key example is what has happened after the abrogation of Article 70. After abrogation of Article 370, we don't have any representative from Jammu and Kashmir in our parliament.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, at some level, this holding together also denies people to articulate their viewpoints very clearly. That's the reason coming together becomes very, very important. Therefore, for me, what happened in Manipur or the abrogation of Article 370, all of that gives an idea very clearly that this is going to be a constant battle. And this holding together will get endorsement of powerful people who are ruling from the capital. But if you are citizens in the periphery, your viewpoint might be different from people who are in the center versus periphery, or coming together and holding together, is going to be the constant attrition what we have to face.
Well, we encourage everyone to check out this book and send you, further questions that they may have. How could people find you or connect with you or send you any follow-up questions or comments about the book?
I am in Twitter. My Twitter handle is Chodmandal Pan. Therefore, if somebody puts a question there, I can answer. They can also email it to me. I am at Rojamuthia Library. My email ID is paneerselvan@rmrl.in.
Thank you so much, Mr. Selvan. It's been a pleasure learning from you about the complexities that define debates in India and in Tamil Nadu, but more importantly about explaining it with such clarity why issues such as caste play a role in Indian politics, how state governments can shape global identity and national identity, and why this battle for coexistence is an important one to discuss because of its ramifications in India and around the world. We truly, truly appreciate your time and hope to have you back soon.